Bill Perry and Annette Talbert, if you'd want to come forward, please. Tell us what this bill does and why we have to pass it. We appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bill Perry. I'm from the Oregon Restaurant Association. And the problem has arose in a few of our employers to where they got caught in a base year employment situation for misconduct. And I guess to try to be as brief as possible, if you let somebody go for a statutory definition of misconduct, it doesn't count against your rating for unemployment insurance. What has happened is they came back, and because there wasn't a director's decision at a later point in the base year claim, they got caught and it charged against their account. We're not trying to affect the employee's benefits. We're just trying to say if they're released from misconduct, they can't come back and they're marked against their record at a later date. Brief description.
Okay. Questions? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members, good afternoon. Annette Talbot, Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. I believe Mr. Perry has explained the bill, and we don't have any policy concerns with the bill as drafted, and just would ensure that the committee understands that it does not affect benefits, and also that the charges will go to some, will be either specifically allocated to an employer's account or spread among all employers, and that's a policy decision we believe is best left to employers and this body. We do have a visual description of how the base year employer works for those of you who kind of need to look back at sort of where we're talking about and why there is a base year and why that employer gets caught in this particular policy quagmire, so to speak, at this point in time. So if that helps you, if you have any questions about base year employment, we'd be glad to answer them. Mr. Chair, and I do understand that this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, which we appreciate since it's not in our department budget, which we've already passed.
Well, we're going to send it to Ways and Means, but we'll probably try to get you to absorb it if we can.
I'm sorry?
I said we're going to send it to Ways and Means, but we're going to try to get you to absorb it if we can.
I understood that from our previous discussion, Mr. Chair. We obviously would understand if that's a policy decision the legislature directs us to do that. We would. We are concerned that there are some other bills with significant workload impacts that hopefully Ways and Means could at least look at those together and have that discussion with us about what we need to reprioritize if necessary.
Okay.
So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Anyone else wants to testify on this bill? Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries, and I would just like to add AOI support to Senate Bill 770.
Okay, thank you.
That's my testimony.
Okay, any questions for AOI? Okay, thank you all for coming to testify today. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing and open a work session on Senate Bill 770.
Mr. Chair, I'd move Senate Bill 770 out of committee at Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
It's without recommendation? Senate the Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Okay.
Adding any?
We're not going to amend it. We think that the bill does what we want it to do without the amendment. Okay. Okay, can we have a voice vote on that, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Carries? I guess we don't have to have a carry because it was the Ways and Means. Thank you very much. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 730, and we have Randy Elmer and Jennifer Weber.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. For the record, my name is Jennifer Weber, representing the Oregon Workers' Compensation Attorneys, and with me is Randy Elmer, an attorney who practices here in Salem and who is the president of the Oregon Workers' Comp Attorneys. Before Mr. Elmer gets into the content of the bill, I just want to let the committee know that we have had this bill before the Management Labor Advisory Committee and have proposed several amendments to the bill and trying to deal with the department and management concerns, and we have not yet been successful in reaching adequate language for all parties, but we do certainly appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee today to let you know the issue that this bill addresses.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Randy Omer. I prepared some written testimony, which may be before you, and if not, I'm sure the clerk has that. I'm here as President of Owatha to testify in support of Senate Bill 730. As you know, the current Workers' Compensation Act does not allow for claimant attorneys to be paid for representing injured workers before the Department of Consumer and Business Services at the first level of review. And this is involving issues that the exclusive jurisdiction lies with the director, which includes medical service disputes and vocational rehabilitation disputes. The reason that I think this is a good bill and why we urge support of this bill is three main reasons. The first and most important reason, I believe, is to allow injured workers to gain accessibility to the review system. Attached to the testimony, I included an exhibit of some information I received from the Ombudsman's Office, the Workers' Comp Division Ombudsman's Office. Since January 1998, they have been statistically tracking the calls they are receiving from injured workers and categorizing those calls to determine what the concerns are. And as you will see, that
Randy, let me just interrupt you for a moment.
Sure.
I don't think probably a couple members here really understand the process, and you're starting pretty far down the process. Maybe if you just take a couple minutes to explain what you're talking about, because I'm not sure they really understand how that works.
Gladly. In our current workers' compensation system, an injured worker who has an accepted claim and is seeking benefits may often have a dispute with the insurer or self-insured employer over medical service issues, which may entail the right to an additional attending physician, reimbursement for prescriptions, reasonableness and necessity of surgery and other procedures, mileage reimbursement, and in many cases, it's a dispute over whether they're entitled to vocational rehabilitation benefits. The statute was amended in 1990 and again in 1995 to vest exclusive jurisdiction with the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services and their dispute resolution branches, so to speak, all of these issues. Before the jurisdiction was vested in DCBS, these were matters concerning a claim, and we were allowed to go to an evidentiary hearing before the board. And the process was the same as with compensability and any other issues concerning a claim before the board, and assessed attorney's fees are allowed before the board for prevailing over denied claims and disputes as such. Now, when the statute was amended, a specific provision was put into the fee portion of the Act to state that attorney's fees are only allowed if the claim is represented at the second level of review, which we call the contested case level. In other words, you submit the dispute to the director. Depending on the dispute, it would either go to the Rehabilitation Review Unit or the Medical Review Unit, and they would issue an order on behalf of the director. If the worker is represented at that level, the statute specifically disallows fees. If it goes to the next level on appeal at the contested case hearing, before an administrative law judge of the Department of Consumer Business Services, and assess fees are allowed if the attorney is successful at that level in obtaining benefits for the claimant. What we are simply asking is that the same rule apply at the first level. If there's representation and you prevail and obtain a benefit for the claimant that was otherwise denied, that we be paid an assessed fee. And one of the main reasons that we need this right now is that the Ombudsman's Office has found that approximately, I think in 36 or 38 calls they receive a month, they're being told by injured workers that they cannot obtain representation. And naturally, if someone's going to provide professional services and go uncompensated, they're probably not going to accept those kinds of cases. And so you end up with an unrepresented claimant who probably does not understand this review process. In fact, I would dare say a vast majority of them do not understand this process, who are either going to give up and not go through the process at all for their lack of understanding, or they're going to try to stumble through the process on their own. This bill would allow for attorneys to be paid, and there would be then some incentive to represent the workers at that level. I can tell you I personally represent a number of clients who I'm already representing on other issues, before the director because they're already my client. It is no fun to be doing that much work and trying to explain, you know, to your partners and your staff why you're not getting paid for it and they don't get the raises and so forth. But it's an accessibility issue at that level. The second concern is the record that's developed. With an unrepresented claimant, they're not going to know exactly what they're going to need to present to the department to prevail on their issue, most likely. Another provision in the statute that's specific to medical services, and I quote that, it's ORS 656.260/16, says that whatever record is made on that medical service dispute before the director, if taken to the contested case level, is frozen. There is no new issues and no new evidence allowed at that level. And so even if at that level, contested case level, the worker obtains representation, that attorney is going to struggle through that portion of the review process with that ill-fated record as it was put together at the first level by that pro se claimant. On the other hand, the insured and self-insured employers are often represented at that level, and certainly can be, and that attorney that represents the insured or self-insured employer, of course, will have a legal obligation as their advocate to prepare the best record they can for their client, an adequate record for review from their perspective, and not necessarily to assist the worker at all. And so the second thing FD 730 would accomplish would be to allow for representation, adequate representation at the first level, and establish a good record for review. So that would be all the way up through the Court of Appeals. And finally, I think the third reason is it's just fair. If a professional is going to provide services and they prevail and help the worker get an otherwise denied benefit, they should be paid for that. I would like to point out that there is no fee paid if there is no benefit derived. This is a purely contingent situation. Thank you.
Questions? Okay. Well, thank you very much for presenting your case. And we'll
hear
a couple more people.
Appreciate your time.
Let's see. Maybe you and Chris want to come up together? Okay. Seeing you all session, you must be hiding.
Yeah, I'm kind of taking a break.
Are you?
Chair Durfler, members of the committee, thank you very much for giving us the opportunity to testify here today. I'm Diana Godwin, and I, as Senator Durfler noted, I've been a lobbyist for a number of years, but this session I'm practicing law most of the time. But I'm here today on behalf of 70 independent practice physical therapy clinics that I represent throughout the state and have done for some 15 years. I particularly represent these clinics in workers' compensation cases on issues about what the medical rules will look like, what the medical fee reimbursement schedules look like, and particularly from the viewpoint of physical therapists who have a particular role in the workers' comp system. And I have become increasingly concerned over the past couple of years when I receive calls from my clinics, my clients, very, very regularly about the fact that a workers' comp insurer has, after the fact, after medical services have been provided to an injured worker in a compensable case, that the insurer is denying compensation, or denying their medical fees. And they call me, and I often have to work with the department to try to get these resolved. In all of those cases, because I represent all these clinics, I have to handle this for free because there is no opportunity for medical providers, when they prevail in a dispute against a workers' comp insurer about the amount of their fee or the reasonableness of their services, no opportunity at any level for the medical provider to get attorney fees. And I agree with Mr. Elders that you've got a real problem with the worker who cannot get attorney fees at the very first level, which is the administrative level, and that is the most important one. It's also very, very important for a medical provider. Again, the same statute, 656.260/16, says that you must make the record at the first level, the department level, because that record then is frozen. And if you can appreciate that while an injured worker may not have the skills and understanding about administrative law and how to make a legal record, a medical provider is in the same situation. We want our medical providers to be competent, trained, caring, medical providers for injured workers. We don't want them to be lawyers. And so, unfortunately, what happens to the medical provider, acting in contrast with the worker, at least once it goes up on contested case or appeal, then there's an opportunity for the injured worker to have representation by a lawyer, and if he prevails, have that attorney fee paid. There's never that opportunity for the medical provider. So I know that what happens, and I've been talking with other medical groups, including the OMA, what happens is when a medical provider is confronted with what appears to be an unreasonable or unintelligible, not understandable denial of their service or of their fee, particularly if the amount involved is, you know, under $1,000 or even under $2,000 or $3,000, they don't have the wherewithal, the resources, or the time, or the knowledge to take this through the process, notwithstanding that they may know that they're right, that insurance claims adjuster is wrong, but these providers are faced with the choice of absorbing that loss, providing their services for free. And again, remember that these are in compensable claims, which means that they cannot go back against the worker to recover for the medical services that have been provided to the worker. And in that kind of a case, and this most often happens where it's after the fact, after the services have been delivered, at that point, the worker, who could get attorney fees at some level, has what I call no dog in that fight. They've received their medical services. They have no liability for paying for them, because, of course, because it's a compensable claim. So they don't have any incentive, or the claimant's attorney has no incentive to try to challenge the insurer because the medical provider didn't get paid. So what I'm here asking to do, and I did talk with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and in the eventuality that this bill as written does not move forward with due path recommendations, if possible, because this bill amends the very, very statute that we need to address this problem of no medical fees for providers, I have drafted amendments which basically say restore all bracketed material and delete all bold-faced material, and then just amend the statute to do nothing other than every time it says attorney fees to a claimant, it says attorney fees to the medical provider who prevails. Again, the same standard would apply. You would get no attorney fees unless, in fact, the medical provider was correct and the insurer was wrong in denying fees. I have a case that happened just, as a matter of fact, about 6 weeks ago. It's apocryphal, but not unusual. I represent a physical therapy clinic down on the South Coast. As you may know, physical therapists cannot treat in the workers' comp system unless they have a referral from the attending physician. So in this case, the attending physician, an osteopathic physician, made the decision that this worker needed physical therapy care, referred the worker to my physical therapist clinic, who then prepared, as required, an immediate treatment plan. Workers' comp medical care guidelines provide for a usual guideline of 20 treatments in the first 60 days. My clinic provided treatments through the end of March. On April 6th, for the first time, the insurance company contacted not my client, but the osteopathic attending physician and said, by the way, we think all services delivered after January 30th were excessive. My client started treating the injured worker on January 9th. I think there were 7 treatments before January 30th. Every treatment thereafter was denied as excessive, unreasonable, notwithstanding that my physical therapist had done everything he was required to do, got the referral from the attending physician, prepared the required treatment plan, sent the treatment plan within 7 days to the insurer so they could see what was planned, sent it to the attending physician. The attending physician signed it. And he, my physical therapist, had been talking with the insurance company as well. So after the fact, on April 6th, all compensation was denied for all treatments after January 30th. Compensable claim, you can't collect against the worker. My physical therapist made his mistake. He tried to represent himself in the dispute resolution process. The amount involved was $3,200. Not a small amount, but not large enough. That could be eaten up with attorney fees quickly. He tried to take himself through the process, did not understand the need to establish the record, lost at the administrative level, tried to go through the contested case proceeding, and then found out, oops, I can't really introduce all this evidence I now have from the doctor, how, you know, everything was done according to Hoyle. So we've got no shot. And that's not an unusual case. I think I probably get a call at least once a week. In some of the cases, I'm able to call the insurer directly and straighten them out about the particular medical rules and fee schedule that applies to physical therapy, because I'm pretty experienced in that area. And I don't know whether you've ever seen it, but that's the workers' comp medical fee schedule, and then the medical rules are a separate one. It's not easy, even for a lawyer, to work their way through this, let alone for a medical provider. I recently testified about 2 weeks ago in front of the workers' comp board, not the board, but the workers' comp department, about some changes they were making in the Division 9 medical fee schedule. And I took the opportunity to sit down before the hearing, and I wound up with 6 pages, single-spaced typed, detailing the difficulty and the Byzantine nature of the dispute resolution process for medical providers. 6 pages, single-spaced, and pointed out all the places at which there's pitfalls. Well, there's a 30-day time limit over here with an MCO claim. You've got to file with the MCO. And then after you're done with that, it's 60 days to apply to the director. But if it's not MCOs, it's 90 days to apply to the director for a dispute resolution. And it goes on and on. And there's, you know, it's Division 15 MCO. If it's a fee dispute, it's Division 9. If it's a services dispute, it's Division 10. And I had a hard time diagramming it and working my way through it. So I think it's time to pay some attention. I know insurers don't want to pay attorney fees. I can appreciate that they would be resistive, particularly because the statute says that the employer then may be responsible for reimbursing those attorney fees. But I would say that by allowing a medical provider to get attorney fees where the medical provider prevails, maybe will cause the insurance companies to do it more carefully in the beginning. And perhaps then the insurance companies will go with the medical providers to the workers' comp department and say, let's make better sense of this dispute resolution process so it is easier for people. So on a small dispute, maybe a medical provider can represent himself. Again, the dispute resolution processes are in 3 different divisions of the workers' comp rules. I've suggested they compile them all in one division, so you only have to go one place. But in the meantime, I feel sorry for these medical providers who do good work. They're needed in the workers' comp system. They may be absolutely right and the insurer wrong, but they have no way to redress that. Thank you very much.
Just one question, then. If you... Can those charges be collected from the regular insurance?
For
the regular medical insurance?
No, because once it's a compensable claim, the regular health insurer, say a Blue Cross, will say, no, this is a compensable workers' comp claim, and they will completely deny. I know whenever there's a claim in dispute or during that 90-day period before a claim is determined to be compensable, I advise my therapist, well, if there is a private health insurer, go ahead and bill them, but don't bill the worker for the copay or the deductible, and then they'll sort it out in the end if the claim is compensable. But once the claim is compensable, and again, all of these cases that I've been involved in, it's a perfectly compensable claim. There's no question about that. But once it's a compensable claim, no, there's no recourse to the health insurer, and of course there's no recourse against the worker. That leaves the medical provider. And I think about these attending physicians who I know are already overwhelmed with the responsibilities of being an attending physician in this system.
Okay. You have any questions? Sure.
I will give my amendments to the clerk. Thank you.
Thank you. Chris, you're going to defend yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Chris Xavier with Safe Corporation. I'm here to speak in opposition to Senate Bill 730. This bill gets to one of the processes that were created by Senate Bill 1197, the first significant reforms back in 1990, where in an attempt to reduce litigation, there were these administrative processes set up within the workers' comp division. It's not a hearing. It's a presentation of the facts and the record to, usually, this isn't strictly medical issues within the scope of this bill, but often a medical issue. And medical experts there take a look at these and make a decision about what's the appropriate treatment. And going beyond that, either party can then request a contested case hearing, and an attorney is able to get an attorney fee for prevailing at that contested case hearing. But the premise is that at the first administrative review level, It's just a matter of looking at the record, and that this is not litigation, and so the worker does not need to be represented. Just because workers usually are not represented, don't think that they don't use that process. There are hundreds of these disputes every year that work through the process at that first level within the workers' comp division.
That's how you respond that if that record then goes forward and it's not properly done, then they, if they contest the case, they have a disadvantage.
Mr. Chair, the record is prepared by the whatever they're called, nurse reviewers within the medical review unit, and it's really based on all the medical evidence that is available, the medical files from the doctor, the medical files from the insurance company, and usually if there is a medical dispute, there is a medical arbiter appointed. In fact, I think in every case, a medical arbiter is appointed. That's somebody that's an independent doctor selected by the workers' comp division. They ask them some questions, the worker is examined by that arbiter, they get a report back. And so the record is really just a summary of the medical information. This isn't something where a person needs to come forward to persuasively make their case, because it should be based on a medical review. We've taken the position in the past that there may be some situations where in a particularly complicated case, there may be a situation where an attorney can make a difference in one of these situations, and perhaps they should be compensated for that. But so far, nobody's really come up with a way to make that work effectively without affecting all the other cases that go forward today. As I said, there's hundreds of these disputes right now. Workers regularly win. I don't have the actual win-loss percentages, but workers win a large number of these disputes. And they obviously do it without legal representation, because you hear that most of the time they can't get an attorney to represent them. And this bill that, in every case, would allow an attorney to represent the worker and to be compensated means that all those cases today where the workers are prevailing without an attorney, then an attorney would be paid for essentially making no difference, because workers are winning those cases today. My understanding is that the projected cost of this is around $500,000, and that cost would, of course, be added to claim costs that are figured into the premium rates and be passed on to employers. Also, this bill doesn't make any equation between the value of the benefit and the attorney fee. A lot of these things are for relatively small amounts. They could, in fact, be just over a prescription. Or I used the example in my testimony of a pair of athletic shoes. Sometimes a physician might say that a worker would do better if they went out and bought a pair of Nikes. Now, that's not a medical prescription usually, and sometimes those things might be disputed. If they were disputed and ultimately the worker prevailed, then the worker would get that pair of Nikes for $75 or $100 or whatever they are, and the attorney fee, according to this bill, would not be limited. It would just be, I think it says, a reasonable fee, which these days means $1,000 or more for a $75 benefit. And then finally, I'd just like to refer you to the final report that came from the Management Labor Advisory Committee last year, in which they said that they thought that attorney fees should be looked at further, but they wanted to do it in the context of an overall review of the workers' compensation adjudication system, not in isolation, and that they wanted to undertake this during after the 1999 legislative session. So we would ask you to take no further action on Senate Bill 730 at this time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
See, we have President of SA.
I am Fred Venata, appearing before you on behalf of Liberty Northwest Company, and you will, if you listen carefully, hear me mumble just a little bit, perhaps. Attorneys at Liberty have spent a lot of time talking about this legislation on numerous occasions. Clearly, claimants' attorneys do some work, add some value, and ought to be compensated in some fashion. We do not support a contingency fee and don't support the language of the bill here, but we do believe that that we ought to work out some system to assure that injured workers can get representation at this level if they have reason to believe they need it, and that and some pay is given to the worker, to the attorney for their contribution there. We do not, we support the concept of the original reform that tries to make this as administrative as possible and not develop into full-blown contested case hearings, and we just start the dispute process there. So with that as a mumble, we would support the concept and stand by to work with folks if there's going to be some language worked out.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Vance Day. I'm a practicing attorney here in town. I represent injured workers. I'm not going to run over ground relating to what Mr. Elmer said. I want to talk about accountability. Mr. Elmer talked about three parts of this bill and why he's in favor of it. I'm in favor for those reasons, but primarily for accountability purposes of insurers. I had a professor once who said, authority without accountability results in great tyranny. And what we have is a system where, and again briefly, where an insurance company, if they decide to contest medical bills, goes ahead and files a, basically telling the department, we contest these, sends a notice to the doctor. You've got an attending physician. My dad's been a doctor for 40 years. He's a family doctor. He's a surgeon. He's supposed to be attending his patients. And he gets in this thing through the billing department, which says, sorry, we're not going to pay for these services on this accepted claim. And he's thinking to himself, hold it. That was a couple months ago. What do I do now? Well, he's got to respond within so many days. And if he doesn't respond and get something before the department, all that's left before these medical reviewers is what the insurance carrier or the self-insured employer has put before them. That's it. I heard the state representative say, this is not litigation. If it's not litigation, then why is the record frozen at the first level? It is litigation, and unless you know the rules of the game, and that it's a game, to get the evidence before there and make sure that these reviewers understand what the full amount of medical information is, then you lose at the next level. You don't have a ghost of a chance. That's one of the main problems. Let me give you a little example of what happened to me about a month ago. I had a client, Safe was the insurer, made a claim, had a terrible fall from a ladder, struck her head, back injury, soft tissue, no fractures, but dizziness problems. Her medical bills were mounting, but her doctors continued to treat her. The claim was denied, so we took the hearing, we took it on a compensability matter, contingency fees, I handled that, and got medical reports, worked with the doctors, they stood behind her 100%, got to the hearings room, and on the doorstep, they said, we'll go ahead and grant her compensability. I said, great. Why fight all the way up to now? And the response from State Council was, well, we hoped that she'd get stuck with the medical bills, frankly, Vance, but we'll go ahead and accept it at this level because we'll win at the medical dispute level. We'll just contest all the bills at the medical dispute level. We'll pay her her time loss, but we'll just get rid of the medical bills because they're so high. Well, this is an issue of good faith. And if we have insurers or self-insured employers who are able to grant compensability and pay minimum benefits, but then wipe out the doctors at the next level without the assistance of at least counsel in some form or fashion, and I do handle it pro bono at that level and try to prepare my clients for that because I think that's our responsibility. But there are fewer and fewer attorneys who are willing to go at that level, develop a record, spend hours of time talking to doctors, making sure things get done, to win at that level, at the first level, and then not have the insurance company appeal to the level where you can actually get paid. Because if they lose at that first level, because you've helped, they're not going to go to the next level where you can get paid. And so it is an economic analysis in part. And I think that when you look at the totality of the situation, if attorney fees are granted at this first level, you'll see a great dip in disputes. So there won't be that many contested case hearings, first or second level. there won't be the overutilization of the department's resources because insurers won't dispute that many things. They'll work them out. They'll call and say, gee, you know, your client had that real expensive drug and we could have given them generic. Can we in the future give them the generic and not, you know, go for this expensive drug? That'll work out. Things will be resolved because there's accountability. If they dispute it and lose, they'll pay some price. And if that's the form of attorney fees, then I think that's the way it should be done. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for testifying.
Mr. Chairman, I didn't make the list, but we got the, are we
able to do this? If you've got a short presentation, we're supposed to go to 3 o'clock, so.
Jim Egan from Albany. I just found out about the hearing, and I rushed down as quickly or up as quickly as I could. I think Vance has very appropriately talked about the issue of accountability from the insurance carrier perspective. From the legislator's perspective, we've got to talk a little bit about stewardship. This legislature and this body created Senate Bill 369, and what you've got to do, I think, after a period of time, is look at the inequities that everybody creates when they legislate, inadvertently, if nothing else, if by no other for no other reason. And in terms of your stewardship, part of the job, I think, of the legislature is to make an incremental change that needs to happen. This is an incremental change. This is a small change under our system, adjusting the benefits to employers under 369 back towards injured workers who have a problem with medical service cases. With regard to Safe Corporation's position that nurse reviewers create these cases and that the records are created by medical professionals, well, that's almost nonsensical. I mean, the bottom line here is that Safe Corporation has a bevy of lawyers preparing each case with their claims adjusters, and the harsh reality is that they are feeding information to the nurse reviewers. Now, who is feeding information to the nurse reviewers from the claimant side? And the answer is nobody. Or if you take the testimony of the physical therapist that came today, non-legal professionals who don't know the right questions and certainly don't know the right answers. If we have claimant counsels consulting with those medical professionals, preparing the cases, then a complete record is made. But if we have, on all on one side, legal types, claims adjuster types, feeding information to the director can't make right decisions. The director must necessarily make lopsided decisions. And that's what's happening with the record today. Finally, I'd like to address Liberty's point with regard to attorney fees. And what I heard Liberty say here today was that this is probably appropriate. Attorney fees at this level are probably appropriate, but they shouldn't be contingent fee agreements. They shouldn't be contingent fees for attorneys. I would refer you to OAR 436-001-0265. That regulates attorney fees. It explains all of the factors that are involved. It explains all of the things that an attorney can do. And then it says, and each one of these things should be a factor in considering a fee. If it's a $75 pair of Nikes, the attorney's fee should be $25. The fact is that Nike story that you heard from Safe Corporation is anecdotal. It's just one little story in, according to the Safe testimony, hundreds of stories. The bottom line is, my medical service cases that I do pro bono, I pick and choose very carefully because the bottom line is I'm not getting paid for them. So I'm going to do an attorney's fee. I'm going to try to develop a case for an attorney's fee at the contested level. If there's a surgery involved, if there's a life-threatening condition involved, if there is a health-threatening condition involved, then I'm not going to take a fee for a $75 pair of Nikes because the benefit to the injured worker is not that substantial, and frankly, it's not going to generate a fee under OAR 436-001-0265. Again, I'd like to just reemphasize, accountability is what the insurance carriers ought to have. stewardship is what the legislators ought to do, and I think that that's a very appropriate thing here. You convene a hearing. It's very appropriate. We thank you for the injured workers. We thank you on behalf of the people that we represent for at least allowing us to be heard on this particular point. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you taking time to come up. I would suggest to you, because we had pretty direct from the governor what he expects and wants, what bills he will veto and pass. My understanding is you probably have taken this through the NMAC group. And need to get their approval before the governor's going to accept the bill. So he said he would veto any bill that didn't get approved by the NMAC group. They have not approved. I would suggest you continue that process and get their blessing before we're going to do much with it. So, thank you. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 730. Yeah.